Good morning. This is our day of launching the public face of the C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest. In the chapel setting, our focus is hearing voices for peace, just pieces of what's prepared. You'll hear more about that a little bit later. We'll respond each time after one or two of the pieces of speeches with Sing the Story, number 16. If you could have that ready, that would be helpful. And just follow along with a handout, and you'll know exactly what to do when, or you can respond in your own way. Let's genuinely seek and pray for peace as we gather this morning.
I'm Heidi Winters Vogel from the Theater Department, and I represent the committee that oversees the C. Henry Smith Peace Oratorical Contest. And I want to give you a little context for what you'll be seeing today. This annual contest was established in 1974, and it offers students an opportunity to discuss peace building and social justice issues on campus. It is administered by the Peace and Justice Ministries of Mennonite Central Committee, and undergraduate students from every Mennonite and Brethren in Christ College in North America are eligible to compete. C. Henry Smith was an American Mennonite historian and a professor at Mennonite Colleges and the University of Chicago. He is well known for his numerous books on Mennonite history and his particular attention to the peace commitments of the Anabaptist tradition. The first place winner in the competition here at EMU receives a cash prize and entry into the intercollegiate competition. EMU has participated in this event since 2003, with EMU students winning the grand prize at the binational level in 2003, 2004, 2007, 2009, and 2011. Yeah. The contest is sponsored by EMU's Bible and Religion Department, Language and Literature, and the Peacebuilding and Development Programs. What we'll see today is portions, 2-minute portions of the 10-minute speeches that will be done on Friday. We have five participants in today's and Friday's competition. We'll begin with a presentation from Jordan Luther, who is a senior biblical studies major, and he has a speech entitled, "Are Y'all Listening? An Apology." Next will be Chris Yoder, who is a senior writing studies major, and he will talk about the scaffolding of our existence. Thirdly, Chris Parks, junior in theater and biblical studies, will talk about dreaming a new America. Sarah Caitlin Newbert, who is a first-year student in computer science, will give us a snippet of her speech entitled, "We're Not Ugly, We Just Stink." And then Seth Stauffer, a sophomore in peacebuilding and development, will finish us up with his speech on the danger of MCC's own single story. Thank you.
I believe I first became self-aware about this link between language and identity while I was making the transition from elementary school to middle school. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. All right, Jordan. There's no way you can be that self-aware at such a fragile age. Now, while I understand your hesitancy, I want to focus on a more local and regional reality from my childhood, the social reality of growing up in the American South. Allow me to paint a picture for you. I grew up in Martinsville, Virginia, a decaying factory town in southwestern Virginia. Well, I actually didn't grow up in the city of Martinsville. Rather, my family and I call Henry County home and have a rural Martinsville address. It is this subtle nuance of geography and space that provides the context for my initial self and social awareness. This is because in elementary school, I was with other rural kids in a small school called Figsboro Elementary, where I was fairly close to my home. In middle school, however, all of a sudden, I was with kids from town. And we could hear the difference between these two groups, whether you came from country or town. And you might ask yourself, how did we do it? And I'd like to say it wasn't that hard for us to hear the difference. There was one time in particular, in sixth grade, where I don't think I said so much as a single sentence when the boy I was talking to decided he had heard enough, and he figured he could crack the code. "Hey, Jordan," he said with an obnoxiously slow drawl, "you don't happen to be one of them Figsboro kids, do ya? 'Cause you sure do sound like it." Believe it or not, even after such an appalling comment from him, we managed to be pretty good friends throughout middle school. Now, you can call me a saint if you wish, but maybe I should just mention that this nuance between the country accents, like me, and those without them, like my friend in this illustration, is quite insignificant in the grand scheme of my identity formation. To be completely honest, all of us had country accents, or apparently southern accents, but we never realized it at the time. We all were so used to hearing our parents and grandparents talk with their southern drawl, there was never an opportunity for us to critically evaluate our southern accents and our drawl, because that was ultimately considered normal. The more disconcerting part of my narrative, though, is when I was blindsided with the reality of what it apparently means to have a southern accent to the ears of those who do not have a southern accent like mine.
Humans have a unique ability, uncommon to many lower order species, to adapt psychologically within their lifespan to a completely new set of overarching rules. In the words of David Primack, emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, animals can perceive perceptual relations. Humans alone have the ability to reinterpret the higher order relations between these relations. These higher order relations, in simpler terms, are what we call culture. So how do humans do it? How can we adapt to new cultures? How do we have the ability to perceive these higher order relations? Here's a little example that needs to be delved into further in the actual speech, but it'll just be a short one now. A college student named Jimmy signs up for a cross-cultural trip to Kenya. He packs his toothbrush, his bags, his clothes, his shiny new camera, and his little white malaria meds. And he hops off the plane and jumps across, he hops on the plane. He'll hop off when he gets there. He hops off the plane when he gets there. When he gets off the plane, he immediately starts sweating, pulls his shirt sleeves up, nudges his buddy and says, "Wouldn't it be great if we had weather like this back home?" He's sweating. Then he pops a malaria pill for safety's sake. Then, after the all-too-short orientation, he's thrown into a house with a host family, and he sends a text to his buddy, "Yo, man, this is awesome. We're living the African life. This is the real deal." Things go well the first day, of course. Introductions are pleasant, and everybody is friendly. You gotta be friendly. Then the food begins to sit wrong. The heat proves that Jimmy's clothing choice was horribly misguided. The mosquitoes bite nonstop and buzz and whine underneath the frayed mosquito net. More little white pills are consumed. So there comes a point in Jimmy's story where he must make a choice that will determine the psychological outcome of all future interactions he has with his host family, with the community he's around, and with the culture he's in. He must ask himself, "Will I reinterpret my identity and cultural assumptions to adapt to the rules of this new culture, or will I continue to apply my previous culture's values upon this one?" And I'll end with a question.
As I stand here, I am reminded of the people who have come before me. Vincent Harding, Michelle Alexander, Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois, Joe Shriver, Donald Crable, Apostle Paul. I must bow my head and remember I can be nothing, will ever be anything if it were not for those who have paved the way for my feet to trot. Langston Hughes once said, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America was never America to me, and yet I swear by this oath America will be. As a 22-year-old whose hair droops like the branches of a willow, my heart grieves for the America that never was for me." The NAACP reports, 1 in 3 black men between the ages of 20 and 35 were behind bars in 2012, and far more were under some form of penal control, such as probation or parole. I am the one that got away. Yet, I constantly look over my shoulder. It is not common for young black teenagers living in the hood to be stopped, interrogated, frisked numerous times in the course of a month or even a single week by paramilitary units, to see the security officer watch me as I buy groceries, to look at the local store owner watch me buying a new shirt, to experience cops pull me over for driving home from church in a beat-up car while black in the United States versus Burgoyne Ponce. The court concluded it permissible under the Equal Protection Act of the 14th Amendment for the police to use race as a factor in making decisions about which motorists to stop and search. This is what America is.
Body image is the perception a person has of themselves. It sets the tone to which a person will carry out every event in their day. Peer interaction at school allows children and teens to develop interpersonal and problem-solving skills that will help them to thrive in the workplace and in their daily life. But if a boy does not want to join a basketball game because he feels inadequate compared to the other players' physiques, or a girl cannot bring herself to stand in front of a classroom because she doesn't want to bring attention to her thighs, they are unable to connect with peers. That social lack can lead to self-consciousness, an inability, a doubt in one's abilities, and anxiousness, to name a few. When these thoughts enter a person's head, simply being told, "Be proud of yourself. Don't listen to anyone else," is not enough. That is suppressing the problem rather than fixing it. As a Christian community, we need to redefine the definition of health and beauty, because our bodies are not made to establish a person's worth. They're made to worship God. If we make healthy and beautiful be about the image of a person who is able to carry out the will of God, children and teens will work towards a realistic goal and develop skills they need to thrive.
Millions have viewed Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's TED Talk, "The Danger of a Single Story." Adichie's speech was widely shared, perhaps among Mennonites more than most groups, and among Mennonites, it was shared most comprehensively to employees and volunteers of Mennonite Central Committee. As it turns out, I was one of those volunteers last summer, and I quickly discovered that the 4-year-old TED Talk had become essential working knowledge for all MCC staff. Adichie's talk names how impressionable and vulnerable we are at the face of a story. She describes how one story is never enough, only one story robs people of dignity and forecloses the possibility of human complexity and connection. Furthermore, stories are a matter of power. How they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told are really dependent on power. For Adichie, power is the ability not to just tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. It is no wonder the talk became so popular in MCC circles so quickly. The synergy of the danger of a single story with MCC's peace position is extensive. Both are intended to be subversive strokes, undermining power hierarchies and the dominant narrative to make space for everyone and all stories. The synergy is there for MCC because the organization does not have a naively humanist peace position. MCC has a Christian peace position, and at times that means following the path of radical, nonviolent resistance. The TED Talk was important to MCC because it articulated a powerful operating guideline. It reinforced MCC's care for all stories, and most importantly for the topic today, gave MCC a seemingly fail-safe way to communicate. It gave MCC the option to focus on telling many stories and to let popular media stories of the world remain unchanged. In adopting Adichie's powerful words, MCC risks losing its radical subversiveness. When the catchphrase "the danger of a single story" is used without Adichie's complexity, it is all too easy to become formulaic. It is all too easy to adopt one's own version of the straight-edge single story. It is all too easy to soften the Christian peace position and leave the dominant stories be.
You are invited to join us to hear the full presentations from the students at 7 p.m. in Martin Chapel on Friday, which is March 28th. Light refreshments are provided by CAC. Now, blessings as you enter the rest of your week, and send a prayer of thanksgiving that spring will overcome the cold.